From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's been a year now since the Exxon Valdez went aground in Alaska's Prince William Sound. On this edition of Fresh Air, Art Davidson, author of a new book on the Valdez oil spill, examines the combination of bureaucracy, complacency, and deception that led to this country's worst environmental disaster. Also today, we meet actor Meshach Taylor. He's the one man surrounded by TV's designing women. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Madonna's new album, featuring music from the movie Dick Tracy. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Richard Ford's new novel, Wildlife. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Warsaw Pact leaders meeting in Moscow today vowed to transform their 35-year-old military and political alliance. They said they'll revamp the pact to reflect the political changes that have broken down barriers between the East and West in Europe. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
The promise of change came after an appeal from Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. Gorbachev told his allies that the Warsaw Pact must be radically changed in order to survive. He also called for new forms of cooperation between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. There have been some calls within Eastern Europe for the abolition of the Eastern Alliance, but today Gorbachev's six allies endorsed his appeal for its continuation as a political pact that no longer functions largely as NATO's military adversary in Europe. In a joint statement issued after today's meeting, the pact leaders said the terms of a new alliance should be drawn up by the end of this year. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Secretary of State James Baker told a meeting of NATO foreign ministers today that the Western alliance must be prepared to meet reasonable Soviet concerns about German unification. The 16 NATO member nations began a two-day meeting today in Scotland. They're expected to give formal backing to a nine-point plan that's intended to respond to Soviet fears about a united Germany remaining in NATO. A U.S. official said that the foreign ministers will also review outlines for a new political role for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Delegates may also try for more flexibility to help break the impasse in conventional arms reduction talks with the Soviets. East and West German authorities jointly announced the arrest in East Berlin of an alleged Red Army faction terrorist. Deirdre Berger has more on the story.
The East German Interior Minister today said 39-year-old Susanna Albrecht did not resist when she was arrested at her home in East Berlin yesterday. West German authorities have sought Albrecht for 13 years on charges of murdering a leading West German banker. East German authorities today said Albrecht has been living under a false name in East Berlin since 1980. East Berlin Interior Minister Peter Distel did not rule out the possibility that Albrecht lived under the protection of Stasi, the former secret police under the East German communist regime. East German authorities today said they are working with West German security agents and hope to make several more arrests in the next few days. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir has reportedly succeeded in forming a narrow right-wing coalition government. An Israeli administration official said today that Shamir has managed to get the support of 62 of the Israeli parliament's 120 members. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials lost 14 points to close at 2,897.33 in active trading. This is NPR News. Officials from 17 Western nations agreed in Paris today to lift export restrictions on some high-technology equipment. The move will make it easier for East European nations to gain access to Western technology. U.S. officials said the Coordinating Committee for Multilateral Export Controls, also known as COCOM, will delete 30 of 116 items from its restricted list as of July 1st. This will make the items, such as machine tools, telecommunications, and computer equipment, available to all nations, including the Soviet Union. Delegates at the two-day meeting also agreed that East Bloc nations could become eligible for preferential treatment if they adopt appropriate safeguards. Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia will likely be the first to benefit, and East Germany pending full political unification with West Germany. President Bush visited Chicago today to raise money for his party's gubernatorial candidate. He also spoke at an elementary school. Allison Keyes of member station WBEZ reports.
First, Bush visited Farnsworth School to meet with 20 principals nominated for Excellence in Education Awards. Then he read a story about reading to children ranging in age from kindergarten to third grade.
On Wednesday nights, we have hot dogs. Have you heard from your dad? Grandma asked Sam. This is Sam, the guy that's raiding the icebox there. Hungry-looking guy. Going in, he's got a whole bunch of something, I don't know what it is, chips.
Bush then spoke with the children about what it's like to be president, telling them he likes the White House because the food is good. Later, he'll speak at a fundraiser for Republican gubernatorial candidate Jim Edgar. For National Public Radio, I'm Allison Keyes in Chicago.
The nation's major retailers are blaming cool, rainy weather for sluggish sales in May. Several major chains said that the unseasonable weather kept consumers from buying traditional spring and summer goods. Stores that depend on sales of seasonal fashions were especially hard hit. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been just over a year since the oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground and spilled nearly 11 million gallons of crude oil into Alaska's Prince William Sound. Though more than $2 billion has been spent on the cleanup, oil still remains. Many birds and fish have returned to the area, but scientists agree that the long-term effects of the spill won't be known for years. My guest Art Davidson has just written a book about the spill called In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. Davidson was the Natural Resource Planning Director for the state of Alaska and now writes articles and conducts studies on the land, wildlife, and native cultures of the state. He's lived in Alaska for 25 years, and he stays in touch with conditions at Prince William Sound.
I was in Prince William Sound last week, just the very tail end of May. And, you know, when you first fly over the sound or you land in a boat and you go among the islands, it looks beautiful. You know, the sun sparkles off the water and you have the mountains and the forest and it just looks beautiful. And then you land your boat and you start walking up the beach and even on the surface of the beaches, most of them look really nice. And then you start to turn over rocks and you find that the oil, this black gooey stuff, is still down in among the rocks. In places along the beach, it looks as if someone's done a poor asphalting job. There are patches and splotches it looks like asphalt. And what's happened is the oil that's in the beach during the winter, some of it has leached and sort of gurgled up. The tides have lifted it up, and it conglomerates and congeals with the little bits of shell and sticks and stones and so forth, and lays there in patches that look sort of like asphalt.
Is the cleaning still in progress?
Well, yes and no. Exxon has a cleaning operation, but it's nowhere near the scale that they had last year. And that decision, Exxon made its decision last year that they weren't going to spend nearly as much money this year, regardless of how the beaches looked. So this year, instead of 3,000 or 4,000 people out there, they have several hundred. They have small crews working with shovels. They'll shovel up the, if they find these patches of sort of asphalt-type material, they'll shovel it up in buckets, haul it away in a little cart, load it onto a boat, and it's shipped down to Oregon to a waste disposal site. The other thing that Exxon is trying to do, which is very controversial and which some scientists believe may cause, enormous problems, is what's called bioremediation. You know, there are all kinds of small little microbes in the salt water. Some of them will digest and process to a certain extent hydrocarbons, oil. Well, they're trying to stimulate these little bugs, these little microorganisms, by feeding them fertilizer, giving them a balanced diet, so to speak. And so this is the controversial Fertilizing the Beaches of Alaska program. Now, one of the problems is that the fertilizer is toxic, and where it's spread out, it kills some of the organisms that are still alive. And that might be a worthwhile trade-off. In other words, if you're really going to help clean up the beach for the long term, maybe it's worthwhile some short term, death of organisms. Well, some of the problems are no one can show for sure that fertilizing all these beaches, and we're talking about hundreds of miles of beaches, no one can show that it's doing any good, that it's making a difference, that it's really helping the organisms digest oil. Some scientists are concerned that it may be creating a chain reaction which is going to come back and cause some real problems. So one of the things that really concerns me is that we're still being used as guinea pigs in Alaska. They're still experimenting, and in a sense, playing Russian roulette. They may create some problems this year that will haunt us for a long time.
Art Davidson is my guest. He lives in Alaska and is the author of a new book called In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. You think that the spill and the difficulty in cleaning up the spill proves that the oil development of the North Slope was based on a false premise, the premise being that the oil companies could contain any spill. They couldn't.
Exactly. You know, we have been misled for years. When the pipeline debate was taking place years ago, in the early 70s, we were reassured. These people, the oil industry brought people in with their $1,000 suits, and they talked about all the precautions and all the state-of-the-art equipment and how they knew how to, you know, control and clean up an oil spill. We found out that they can't do it. After the spill, and some of within my investigations, I quote a highly placed oil executive, and he said, he confided to me, that a myth has been perpetuated, particularly on the people of America. And for years, this myth has been that the oil industry can control, can pick up a large oil spill. He said, we cannot do it. If you have a large spill, it's going to be out of control, and we have to face that fact fair and square. So I think it is that the lesson here is not just that Exxon made mistakes, but that doing whatever they felt they could do, it was still out of control. And the scary thing is that a year later, we're no better prepared either in Alaska or anywhere along the coast of West Coast or East Coast, the Gulf Coast of the States. We're no better prepared today than we were a year ago. And these tankers don't go aground every day, but when the next one goes ashore, goes aground, we're going to have another dreadful, dreadful, dreadful spill.
Now, you're not trying to take any of the blame off Exxon's shoulders, but you are saying in your new book that there are many others who are at fault, too. And you point, for instance, to Alyeska, the consortium of oil companies that own the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
Yes.
It was their responsibility, really, on paper, right, to take care of any oil spill?
Exactly. They made many, many public reassurances when they were trying to get a permit to build this pipeline and run these tankers up to Alaska. Reassurances that they could handle any kind of oil spill, that they would be there. In addition to all these public reassurances, Congress made them make a binding commitment that they would have a contingency plan that could handle any size of spill. This was a condition of being able to develop this oil. And they told us, they told the state of Alaska, the Coast Guard, and everybody that they were prepared. Here's our plan. We have these people. We have these boats. Well, it turns out, when the spill happened, that they simply were not prepared. They weren't out there within an hour or two as they were supposed to. It took them 9 hours to get their first boat out to the tanker. And then their equipment wasn't working, and it was clearly beyond them. Meanwhile, the consortium of Alyeska was trying to hand off the spill as quickly as possible and as quietly as possible, so the public didn't see, to Exxon. So Exxon was flying up from Texas, scrambling, and I think in many instances the Exxon people did whatever they could and tried their hardest to contain the oil. But here, they're trying to mount a response from thousands of miles away. They're flying into Valdez. Where am I going to stay tonight? Where's a phone? Where's this? Where's that? And they're trying to control an oil spill, which really is like a house on fire. You know, you can't sit around debating how you're going to attack it, how you're going to solve the problem. You have to immediately be on it.
Well, the picture that you paint is of all these groups, including the state government and the federal government, Exxon, Alyeska, all wondering, well, who's going to take responsibility for this? Who has authority here? And everybody's slowing down everybody else since no
yes.
one stood up to take responsibility right away.
It was chaotic and confusing. And one of the things, which is to a certain extent been covered up, is that the federal government, our own government, is supposed to be prepared to step in and clean up any kind of oil spill anywhere, anytime, if the spiller is not responsible or if the spill is too large for them. In this case, in those early days, there was a lot of debate behind the scenes as to whether the government should federalize the spill, take it over. Unfortunately, our own government was less prepared than Exxon. One admiral confided that it would take the government 2 weeks just to set up the paperwork to begin hiring people and leasing equipment. And by then, you know, it was totally out of control. So the spill was like a hot potato. Nobody really wanted it. Alyeska threw it up in the air and sort of tossed it at Exxon. The federal government did not want to federalize it. They didn't have the money. They didn't have the equipment. They didn't have the procedures to do what they were supposed to do and, you know, step in and stand behind an oil company. And so Exxon was left with what proved to be an impossible task.
What about the state government in Alaska? You say they were reluctant to take action because they didn't want to be sued if anything went wrong.
That's right. Behind the scenes, there was this tremendous concern for, well, if we tell Exxon to do this, it may come back to haunt us in court. If we begin cleaning up ourselves, we may be accused of interfering. And it was behind the scenes, there was this tremendous concern that if the state did all these different things that some of the people wanted to do, that they wouldn't be able to have as strong a suit and collect as much money in court from Exxon. And, you know, the state's role in this is very, very disturbing to me. Now, I've been an Alaskan for 25 years, and I love the state, and I love Alaskans, and I'm an Alaskan myself. But the fact is, over the years, we've enjoyed tremendous wealth and many benefits of oil, building our schools, our highways. There's even a program where each Alaskan gets something like $800 just free money each year from our oil revenues. But while we've had all these benefits, we've barely put any money at all into oil, protecting our environment and our communities from oil spills and from other environmental problems.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the impact of the oil spill. My guest is Art Davidson. He's the author of the new book, In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, Art Davidson, is the author of the new book, In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. He lives in Alaska and has written many studies and articles about the land and wildlife there. You know, in addition to being an environmental tragedy, the oil spill was also an oil public relations problem for the companies involved with the Alaska pipeline. Do you think that the public relations end of this helped in the cleanup process, or do you think it put energy into projects that weren't really going to pay off environmentally but would look good superficially?
Well, I think the public relations aspect of the spill are fascinating and also terrifying. I think that, I mean, Exxon obviously poured a lot of effort and money into trying to save its public image, trying to portray that the spill was not as bad as it was, there wasn't as much death and destruction. They sent out little brochures to their cardholders and stockholders and so on and so forth. A lot of baloney. But Exxon also made some very serious mistakes with public relations. I think one of the most fundamental mistakes Exxon made was that their top people, the people that work in the glass towers in New York and so forth, did not come to Alaska, did not walk those beaches, get oil on their hands, pick up some dead birds, and see the fear and the sense of helplessness in the face of Alaskans. If they had sensitized themselves, I think that they would have made a lot of more careful and better decisions on how to manage the cleanup, how to work with Alaskans, and how to and perhaps have been more committed to the cleanup. They also would have gotten some good public relations out of it. But ironically, their top person in Alaska, Frank Irasi, who responded that first morning and flew up to Alaska, within 2 weeks he had begun to earn respect of some of the Alaskans who were most affected, some of the fishermen, the Coast Guard people, and because he seemed to care and he seemed to be trying to do whatever he could to, you know, lessen the damage. After 2 weeks, Exxon pulled him out. Now, the official reason was that he was exhausted, he needed to go prepare for hearings. But it's my speculation that Exxon wanted somebody in charge there who would be able to, you know, hold a tougher company line. And so they brought somebody who had been in Australia, and they continued to manage the spill, the cleanup from thousands of miles away. That's where the people were who were making the key decisions.
What's at stake for the oil companies? What do they stand to lose because of the bad PR from the oil spill?
Well, as one oil company executive put it in one word, he said, the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. They want to drill in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, and they were on track to get Congress to open it up for them and until the spill happened and showed that they're totally unprepared to handle large spills.
Exxon poured a lot of money into Alaska during the cleanup, and you say that some of the people in Alaska ended up becoming spillionaires. I mean, they ended up making making money from the spill.
Yes.
How did that work? Who actually made money from it?
Well, you know, this spill brought out the best in some people and perhaps the worst in others. There were people in Alaska, people from all over the country that flew in there and said, look, I'm here to help. I'm going to volunteer. You don't have to pay me. I want to save some birds. If I save one otter, it's worth it. I'll work all summer to save one animal. There were other people who managed to get hired and looked at the spill as a chance to get rich. Many people, Alaskans who were being hired or were offered these jobs, also felt that they were being bought off. They were being paid. Some people were being paid a tremendous amount of money. And when you're being paid a lot of money, very often you're tempted not to talk against your boss, the person, don't bite the hand that feeds you. Some fishermen in the early days were hired, paid a lot of money to just go out there and park your boat. We don't have anything for you to do right now. Get out of sight and don't talk to anybody about what you see.
You've worked with Native communities in Alaska. What affected the spill and all the people coming up for the cleanup have on life for natives in Alaska?
Well, of course, many native people in Alaska live in villages far away from Prince William Sound, mm-hmm. and were not directly impacted. But there were quite a few villages in Prince William Sound and on down the coast towards Kodiak, which are small villages, maybe a couple of hundred people. And these people live there because traditionally and still today, they're tied to the ocean. They do a lot of fishing. They do a lot of hunting. And they depend on the sea. It's their source of life. So when the spill came and the oil washed onto their shores, one of the most frustrating things and painful things for them was that nobody could tell them for sure what was safe to eat and what wasn't, or if they would ever be able to fish again and eat the clams and eat the mussels. And it was just like the death of the world to them. Now, probably as the years go on, it's going to be safe for them to fish and to collect clams and mussels and so forth again. But how soon? They're not sure. And certainly last year they lived with this terrible uncertainty.
My guest is Art Davidson, and he's an Alaskan who's written about land and wildlife there. And his new book is called In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. Would you or anyone else in Alaska want to return to life before the Trans-Alaska Pipeline? It just seems to me that Alaskans have paid a really tragic price for the oil, but I think a lot of Alaskans feel that over the years they had many benefits from it.
Oh, that's right. Today, and over the last years since Prudhoe Bay has come online, something like 80% of our state budget is funded from oil revenues.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people's jobs tied into it. And so Alaska has been, in a sense, tied in a sense bought off by the oil industry a long time ago. Now, there are individual Alaskans who, and myself included, would be happy to go back to those days, live without Prudhoe Bay, live without all the boom and bust economy that the oil has created, and also do without some of the benefits. I think most Alaskans, however, and this is, of course, what has played out, we're addicted to that oil money.
What safety standards would you like to see to prevent another disastrous oil spill?
I'd like to see the Coast Guard well-funded so that they can really do their job of guarding our shores. I'd like to see the oil industry be required to have double-hulled tankers. I'd like to see the liability laws set so that each state can require full liability of an oil company if it causes a spill like this. I'd like to see the industry know that if it causes damage, it's going to have to do its very, very, very best to rectify the damage and pay for the damages. And I'd like to see us begin to wean ourselves from such a wasteful use of energy. You know, we're such a wasteful society. I'm not talking about stopping our use of cars tomorrow, abandoning our cars and walking to work, but finding more fuel-efficient cars, finding many, many ways that exist to use less energy. Therefore, we'll rely on, we don't have such a heavy reliance on shipping oil to our cities, and which in turn creates more pollution. So I think there are many things we can do. Another very, very fascinating and important effort is just growing, and that is what's called the Valdez Principles. And this is being developed both by environmentalists and some environmentally aware corporations. And it's a sort of a Ten Commandments, if you will, for industry to adopt, saying, if a company will sign on, they'll be saying, look, we're going to do our best to be environmentally responsible, be energy efficient, and we'll even provide an audit each year of our company's activities to show what progress we're making. So the Valdez Principles is something that industry can take on to do their job, to sort of develop a corporate consciousness, to develop a method to watch how they're doing business.
During our conversation, you've talked about things that went wrong during the cleanup and people and organizations and companies that avoided responsibility. Were there heroes? Do you think of there as being any heroes?
There were. There were heroes. There were individuals on every side of this crisis who worked very hard within the Coast Guard, within the state government, within Exxon. I think that Exxon did do some things well. One of the untold stories or barely known stories from the spill is that we could have had three times, four times as much oil out there in the water. That was the oil remaining in the ship. That ship almost dislodged itself from the reef. And had it dislodged itself, the nautical engineers tell us that it very likely would have capsized, broken apart, and all that oil would have gotten out there. Exxon did a good job of getting that oil off and onto another tanker. They call it lightering. And they did a good job at that. So I think there were heroes. There were individuals who worked their heart out and did some good. A lot of the volunteers who came up and tried to save the sea otters and the birds. No, they didn't save thousands and thousands of birds, but they saved individual birds and individual creatures. They showed that they cared. They made a little difference. And so I think those people were real heroic.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Art Davidson's new book is In the Wake of the Exxon Valdez, The Devastating Impact of the Alaska Oil Spill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Washington Post reporter Elizabeth Buemiller on the women of India, a nation where the birth of a daughter is still considered a calamity, but a nation that was ruled by a woman, Indira Gandhi. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet actor Meshach Taylor. He plays Anthony in the TV series Designing Women. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Madonna's new album. It features music from the new Dick Tracy movie, including a couple of songs written by Stephen Sondheim. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Richard Ford's new novel, Wildlife. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela has said the lifting of the state of emergency in South Africa is a victory for all the people of the country, but it doesn't fundamentally change things. Mandela made the comments in Paris after meeting with French President François Mitterrand. Roger Morier reports from Paris.
At the same time that South Africa's President de Klerk was announcing the end of the state of emergency in that country, Nelson Mandela was having a private lunch with France's President Mitterrand. Mandela came out of that meeting to say he was pleased with the news.
We don't claim it as a victory for the African National Congress. It is a victory for the people of South Africa as a whole, black and white.
Nevertheless, says Mandela, the changes in South Africa, today's included, are cosmetic, more style than substance. For that reason, he's on a 13-nation tour, during which he will try to convince European and North American leaders to continue sanctions against the government in Pretoria. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Morier in Paris.
In a statement aboard Air Force One today, President Bush hailed the decision to lift the state of emergency, calling it another significant step towards creating a climate conducive to negotiations that will lead to a democratic, non-racial South Africa. The Senate today was unable to cut off debate on an anti-crime package, which, among its provisions, includes curbs on semi-automatic weapons. The vote represents a victory for the National Rifle Association, which opposed the gun control measures. The bill would also impose the death penalty for 30 federal crimes, and it would speed up executions of federal prisoners. Since there are 300 proposed amendments to the bill, the Senate's inability to end debate on the subject could mean that opponents will be able to talk the bill to death. The House today voted to override a presidential veto of a bill that would have authorized $2 billion for Amtrak. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The House vote was 294 to 123, more than the two-thirds needed to override a presidential veto. President Bush vetoed the Amtrak funding bill because he objected to a provision in the legislation that would have given increased power to the Interstate Commerce Commission. Democrats who supported a veto override argued that the ICC needed more power to prevent corporate raiders from dismantling the nation's rail system. The veto override question now goes on to the Senate, which is expected to vote sometime today. There, the vote is expected to be much closer. Both houses of Congress have yet to successfully override any of President Bush's 10 legislative vetoes. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Stock prices closed down today with the Dow Jones Industrial Average losing 14.32 points to close at 2897.33. Losing stocks outnumbered advancing issues by a 4-3 margin in active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The much-hyped release of the movie Dick Tracy next week is being accompanied by the release of three related recordings. You'll be able to get the film's soundtrack by Danny Elfman, who also did the soundtrack for last summer's blockbuster Batman, and a Dick Tracy album with artists ranging from Take Six to K.D. Lang. But already in the stores is Madonna's new album, inspired by the movie. She, of course, is one of the stars. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Madonna may be the world's most interesting pop star, but that doesn't always mean she makes the world's most interesting music. I'm Breathless, music from and inspired by the film Dick Tracy. That's the darn thing's full name. Sounds like the kind of experiment an artist can feel compelled to conduct after making so many records in the same style. In Madonna's case, that style has been dance music, but her experiment is to see if she can stretch her style to accommodate older pop forms.
I'm going bananas, and I feel like my poor little mind is being devoured by piranhas, for I'm going bananas. I'm non-combatantes, and I feel like a tooth being drilled and nerve being killed by a dentist, for I'm non-combatantes. Who knows?
That's I'm Going Bananas. In Dick Tracy, Madonna plays slinky nightclub singer Breathless Mahoney. Accordingly, most of I'm Breathless is a series of genre exercises, attempts to write new versions of 30s and 40s pop songs. Only two of the album's 12 cuts are actually in the movie. One of them is this song, written by Stephen Sondheim. It's a duet with Mandy Patinkin, who plays her piano player in the film.
But what if she goes? At least now you have part of her. What if she had to choose?
Leave it alone.
Hold it on in.
Better a bone, don't even begin with so much to win. There's too much to lose.
In general, I'm Breathless is a bold idea, an admirable one, but there's no reason why we have to applaud it or fake enthusiasm for what is essentially a betrayal of Madonna's best talents. Some fans are praising the record as an answer to all her skeptics, as proof that Madonna can really sing. I don't think Madonna fans should be so defensive.
Got my diamonds, got my yacht, got a guy I adore. I'm so happy with what I got. I want more. Count your blessings. One, two, three. I just hate keeping score. Any number is fine with me, as long as it's more. As long as it's more. I'm no mathematician. All I know is addition. I find counting a bore.
I'm amounting, your account knows accounting.
I got rhythm, music too.
Listen, questions of technical prowess are always the last refuge of pop culture philistines. The notion of whether Madonna can really sing matters about as much as whether Andy Warhol painted those soup cans by hand. What does matter is the final creation, its artistic achievements, pleasures, or lack of them. On these terms, Madonna's earlier hits make her an entirely successful artist. She didn't need to prove herself. I'm Breathless contains one non-period piece, the hit single Vogue. It's certainly not great, but she sings it without self-consciousness, and it's the best song on the album.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Imagination.
fresh air. You probably know Meshack Taylor for his role as Anthony in the TV series Designing Women. Anthony is the delivery man for a company of four women interior designers. In this episode, one of the women, Suzanne, wants to help her maid Consuela solve her immigration problems. Suzanne decides the only solution is to impersonate her maid at the immigration office.
Suzanne, excuse me for being nosy, but has it occurred to you that Consuela is Spanish and you don't even have an accent?
No. Hadn't occurred to me. That's a good point.
Well, Anthony, you speak Spanish, don't you?
Thank you, Charlene. Remind me to return this favor someday.
That's a great idea. That's perfect, Anthony. You could do this. And you know, whoever goes down there today is the one who has to come back and take the test. It's perfect because you're good at taking tests and you speak Spanish.
No hablo español. Je parle français.
Oh, come on, Anthony. Please do this for me. All you got to do is wear this scarf and this coat and I'll pay you.
Oh, no way. You can just forget about that. Get it out of your mind.
$1,000.
Well, maybe I could just try it on.
Designing Women isn't Meshack Taylor's first TV series. He was also in the short-lived series Buffalo Bill, which starred Dabney Coleman as an egotistical talk show host and Taylor as his assistant director. Meshack Taylor is in Philadelphia filming the sequel to the movie Mannequin. He took some time off the set to come to our studio. I asked him how he got the part in Designing Women.
Well, I went through the ordinary audition process, I guess you could say. I was called in to read for it. I got there, and there was no script. Linda Bloodworth Thomason and her husband, Harry Thomason, were there, and the producer and a head writer of the show. And they asked me what I would do in a certain situation as a specific character, the character that they had in mind. And I did an improv, I guess. And I was in good form that day. I went on for about 5 minutes. I had to be stopped. So they hired me on the spot.
To drag you off.
Yeah, they did. They said, well, this is great. We like what you're doing. We'll hire you on the spot. And they told me then that I would do like 5 episodes. They said, you know, you'll be a recurring character this season and you'll come back 5 times. Well, after I did the first show, I never left. I was there from then on.
Do you know if the character was written specifically for a black actor?
It wasn't. I was the only black guy that auditioned for it. As a matter of fact, I was called in because the lady who cast the show is a friend of mine and told them that she thought I could do the job. But it definitely was not written for a black guy.
What reactions do you usually get when you go in for a role that doesn't specify black character?
Well, ordinarily, you don't get the opportunity to do that. That's one of the problems with Hollywood. It'll say policeman, and unless it says black policeman, a lot of times you won't even get the opportunity to read for it, you know, which is kind of crazy. But that's the way it is, and it's something that we deal with in Hollywood all the time and something that we're fighting all the time, but it's still something that exists.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you got criticisms from some civil rights groups for taking the role because mm-hmm. it was an ex-con, a delivery person.
Right.
What was your maybe you can elaborate on what the criticisms
well,
were, but
I think
what was your response?
You know, people were sensitive because the character was an ex-convict. Well, first of all, like I said, I was the only black guy that read for the part.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it would have been a white ex-convict if it hadn't been a black ex-convict. I certainly wanted the job.
Uh-huh.
And I saw nothing wrong with being an ex-convict. I mean, he's somebody who had been involved in a situation where he went to jail, and now he was out, and he was trying to do something with his life. I think that's positive as opposed to negative. So I didn't feel intimidated by that. I just felt like here's a man who's an ordinary guy who's going to do something special with his life. He's going to try to salvage what's left of it. So I thought that was good. As far as being a delivery man is concerned, I see nothing wrong with being a delivery man. I don't, you know, black or white or Hispanic or Chinese or whatever, you know. It's a job. It's not brain surgery. He's not the president of the United States, but he's working every day, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Was that the first time you had to defend taking a role?
No, it wasn't, because I did role the role of Jim, this runaway slave in Huckleberry Finn. I did for at the Goodman Theater a few years ago, and was very, very surprised because the theater was picketed because of the use of the word nigger in the script. We had no illusions about the word being offensive. We knew the word was offensive. It was slavery was also very offensive. So we felt like to reflect that time, to be authentic, we had to use the word. And people were upset by that. But so, you know, that was a... But once again, I didn't agree with that. I felt that that it was correct to do it that way. I thought it was correct to show that in this period of time that Mark Twain was writing about, black people, African Americans, were dehumanized to the point that they were not even considered people. They were referred to, even by nice white folks, as niggers. And so, I thought that was poignant. I thought that was something that young African Americans, as well as young white Americans and Hispanic Americans, should know about.
You got your start in theater.
Yes.
And you actually got your start in Chicago at the Organic Theater and the Goodman Theater.
Right.
And you're part of what I guess you guys refer to as the Chicago Connection.
Yeah, I think so.
A bunch of actors. There's you and Dennis Franz, Joe Mantegna.
Yeah. Lionel Smith, there's Gary Sinise, John Malkovich, there's Glenn Headley, beautiful actress. There are a lot of us, and then there are the people from Second City as well, the people who worked in improvisational theater and improvisational comedy at Second City.
When you decided to settle in Chicago for a while, did you have any sense of what was happening in theater? Is that what kept you there, or what got you there?
That's what got me there. I was doing a national touring company of Hair, and the last stop was a theater called the Mill Run Theater in Chicago.
I have to ask you, since the national touring production of Hair pretty well launched your acting career, do you actually like Hair?
Did I like the show?
Yeah.
Yes, it was great fun. I had a ball. Are you kidding me? It was really, because, you know, now it's old hat because, you know, there's so many other things that came afterward that were not structured tightly, like it wasn't structured tight. There's a lot of freedom. I could, you know, the bits that I had in the show, I could change every night if I wanted to, and no one minded. And so that was fun.
What songs did you get?
I played HUD. Well, when I first started out, I started out singing the Aquarius solo. But about 2 months on the road, I went from a first tenor to a baritone because your voice can't take that kind of strain every night. You know, that's a lot of singing, and my voice dropped. But and so then it turned out great because then I got a chance to play the male, the black lead in the show HUD. And I did that for a long time. So I got to sing Colored Spade and a bunch of, you know, A.B. Baby and a whole bunch of the kind of comedic tunes. And it was great.
Would you like to be singing more, and what would you like to be singing?
I'm starting to sing again now. I'm singing a lot on my show, on Designing Women now, and I like it, but singing is very difficult because you have to sound good. You don't want to ever sound bad, right? And sometimes you don't feel like singing like that, you know? You don't feel like investing that much in what you're doing as far as like, you can't talk that much after you work tonight because you have to sing tomorrow. So you have to rest your voice. And you become like a real prima donna about your voice. And I've been there, and I don't think I like that anymore. I like to holler every now and then and just have fun. And you have to really, you know, and I have a lot of friends who are singers, and they're, you know, they're walking around with towels around their necks and stuff. And I don't want to do it. If I can just jump up and sing something every now and then, that's good enough for me. But to actually pursue it the way that I was pursuing it for a while, it's just not something I'm not into that anymore.
Your parents are both professors. Did you grow up on a college campus?
I grew up on Dillard University's campus in New Orleans, Louisiana, up until the time I went to high school. Then my parents moved to Indiana to... Well, you know, this was still during the Jim Crow era, so opportunities are very limited in New Orleans and at that time. And my father and mother wanted not only better opportunities for themselves because they're very well educated and felt that they should be able to get better things for themselves, but also for my brothers and sisters and myself. They wanted us to have better opportunities. But what happened was moving there was not really the boon that we thought it was going to be because it lacked sophistication, the town did. And so what we gained on one level, we lost a lot on another. When we were in New Orleans, even though it was a Jim Crow town, African traditions, musically, the whole Creole thing. In New Orleans, people, you had Creedence as people. But in Indianapolis, no.
You know, you come from this really educated family. So many of the roles for black actors in movies and TV are for streetwise, uneducated characters. Yeah. Did you have to learn that kind of language in order
to learn that kind of language to survive. Because, like I said, I was raised on college campuses at the time I went to high school. Then I wasn't there anymore.
Right.
So when you come in talking like, they used to call me the professor, that, you know, you're talking like that, you're going to have some problems. It's a peer group thing. You know, you're going to have to learn how to... So now I'm bilingual, you know.
Right.
I learned that lesson very well. And so I didn't have to learn it for Hollywood. I had to learn it for life and for survival. And I think I learned it pretty well because I can move in and out of those types of situations with a lot of facility, I think. You know, so... It's been very interesting to have that duality in my life.
Well, great. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Actor Meshach Taylor, you can see him Monday nights in the series Designing Women. Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Today in South Africa, President F.W. de Klerk has announced the lifting of emergency measures in that country. They've been in effect for 4 years now. Also, 48 political prisoners to be freed. There are reports of continuing ethnic violence in Kyrgyzstan, the Soviet Asian Republic. Trouble in Poland within the Solidarity leadership. Various groups are maneuvering for power as Lech Wałęsa gets set for a run at the presidency, possibly this fall. There's renewed concern about the state of highway bridges in America, damaged especially after the flooding that happened in Texas. Also, some long-ago memories from Scotland about ham and chocolate.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Richard Ford is one of our country's most acclaimed contemporary authors. He's lived and worked in a variety of regions, and his fiction has been set in locales ranging from Montana to Mississippi and New Jersey. Ford's new novel is Wildlife. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
In his wonderful 1986 novel, The Sports Writer, Richard Ford gently damned academics as anti-mystery types. He says that real mystery, the very reason to read, and certainly to write any book, is to academics a thing to dismantle, distill, and mine out into rubble. I'm afraid that Ford is basically right, and that his judgment applies to book critics as well. Believe me, if I had 3 hours instead of 3 minutes, I'd just read you chunks of Wildlife to let its mysterious blend of humor, regret, and wonder speak for itself. Ford's writing gives professional literature dissectors a hard time anyway. His novels and short stories never sound like much when you talk about them. The Sports Writer was about, well, a sports writer going through a midlife crisis. His 1987 short story collection, Rock Springs, chronicled the lives of people who had chased the American dream out west, only to wind up stranded in cheap motels. And now Wildlife tells us about a few shaky days in the life of Joe Brinson, whose parents separate when he's 16 years old. No, Ford's work isn't compelling because of exotic plots or characters, but because of its moody silences and spare, on-target phrasing. It's as though Ford's writing has been shaped by the same forces that carved out the Western landscapes of his most recent fiction. Wildlife is a coming-of-age novel set in 1960 in Great Falls, Montana. Joe Brinson has moved there with his parents, a lower-middle-class couple who hoped to make money during the oil boom. Joe tells us that his father liked Great Falls. He thought it was wide open and undiscovered, and no one had time to hold you back, and that it was a good time to live there. He was a man, more than most, who liked to be happy, and it must have seemed as though he had finally come to his right place. But the boom goes bust shortly after the family settles in town. Joe's father loses his job as a golf pro and his easy optimism. Trying to shake off depression, he volunteers to fight the forest fires that are raging in the nearby mountains. After Joe's father disappears into the inferno, Joe and his mother are left in kind of an emotional limbo, and she falls in love with another man. Narrating the story years later, an adult Joe describes his confusion. "I wondered if my parents had had troubles that I didn't know about, or if they had always had their heads turned slightly away from each other, and I hadn't noticed." Everything and everybody in Joe's world has begun to run wild, just like the forest fire. When his father returns and tells him about seeing a burning bear scrambling to escape by climbing a burning tree, you know that's how Joe feels, trapped by forces out of his control. Wildlife is a compassionate novel about the painful, extended helplessness of late adolescence. Ford probes the limits of love between husband and wife and parent and child, and somehow he also manages to convey the mystery of those relationships intact.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Richard Ford's new novel, Wildlife. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Ojiva Blytus, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Elizabeth Buemiller discusses the lives of women in India and the growing feminist movement there. Also, Walter Mosley on his new crime novel about an amateur black detective who takes on a case that brings him into threatening parts of white America. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.